Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. After day two of the Democrats' virtual convention, we get down to the main business coming up over the next couple of days. But I thought it was a very, very odd split screen yesterday. I wrote about this in my newsletter. So you have on the one hand Cindy McCain and Colin Powell speaking at the DNC, which formally nominated Joe Biden. Meanwhile, down in Florida, I don't know if we're going to spend a lot of time on this. Laura Loomer, who is a certifiable nut job. I mean, she's this anti-Muslim conspiracy theorist. I mean, certifiable. Somebody from the Alex Jones, Roger Stone corner of the right-wing fever swamp actually won a Republican primary for the congressional seat that represents Mar-a-Lago. This comes a week after you have a QAnon follower who's nominated in Georgia. And not surprisingly, the president is all in embracing the crazy, tweeting out congratulations to Laura Loomer. But here's the point that I hope we get into a little bit later. You know, Donald Trump did not make Laura Loomer the nominee down in Florida. She beat five other candidates. So Donald Trump, you can blame him for a lot of things, but it was the voters that chose the QAnon conspiracy theorist in Georgia. And it was the voters down in Florida who nominated Laura Loomer. So if you want to know how deep is the rot run in the Republican Party, wow. Okay, so to discuss all of this, including what happened and didn't happen at the at the Democratic Convention last night, we continue our special coverage. Joe Lockhart, former White House spokesman and the founder of Words Matter podcast, and Shirish Date, known as SV Date, who managed to annoy the president with a question that he didn't answer. And thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Same here.
Shirish, I should mention you're the chief White House correspondent for the Huffington Post. Should we just start off with your question? Your one moment. You get to ask a question of the president of the United States. And this is how it went.
President, after 3.5 years, do you regret it all the lying you've done to the American people? All the lying, all the dishonesties.
That who has done?
You have done. Tens of thousands.
Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about the payroll tax.
So he didn't answer your question.
No,
did you think he was going to answer your question?
I didn't know what he was going to do. I had gamed out what the possible options were. One, and the most obvious one was just to ignore it and move on. But sometimes he picks fights. Sometimes he gets in back and forth with you. No, I'm not the liar. You're the liar. And you're fake news and so on. So I had no idea. I did try to ask that question 4 months ago. And I made the mistake of prefacing it with, there's a new poll out that shows that your credibility is very low. And my next sentence was going to be, do you regret it all the lie? And he just walked all over me as soon as I said the word poll. It was with Sleepy Joe Biden polls, 96%, blah, blah, blah. And he went on and asked someone else. That was it. So I learned my lesson that time that you need to get to the question immediately.
Okay, since we're in the business of asking awkward questions that might not get an answer, so Joe, thanks for coming back on the podcast. You used to be a spokesman for the White House. You had to deal with obnoxious reporters like Shirish. You used to work for Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had a very, very brief cameo appearance last night, overshadowed by a lot of the other appearances last night. I guess I have to ask this question. In the era of Me Too, how has Bill Clinton not been canceled? Why is he still being featured by the Democrats? Your thoughts.
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One is Joe Biden and his team want the people speaking at the convention that they think will motivate voters to go to the polls. So it's no one forced them to take Bill Clinton. They think and they know, and I think I know, that there is a huge following in the Democratic Party that respects what he did and the contributions he's made since he's left the presidency. Secondly, different from, you know, most of a lot of people who have been quote unquote canceled, you know, he owned up to what he did. And, you know, he's made his regrets known. And it is a piece of his legacy. But there's many other parts of his legacy that are positive. And I think he did a great job of doing what he did in 2012, which was defining a choice, which is it's either door number one or door number two. And, you know, he made it pretty clear that door number one as Donald Trump was not a good choice.
Okay, so let's just look at the overall. The Tuesday night convention is usually kind of the, I don't know, it's kind of the orphan moment. I mean, Monday you start off, you know, with the keynote speech, and obviously that was dominated by Michelle Obama. Tonight, Kamala Harris will speak, and of course, you know, tomorrow night is the big acceptance speech by Joe Biden. So, Shirish, 30,000 foot, how is this going? On one level, the ratings seem to be down. I think people have gotten used to the strangeness. But your sense as a reporter watching this, is this working for the Democrats so far?
I think it's working as well as any convention works, has worked in the last, you know, several election cycles. I mean, it's basically an ad for the party that it's almost an anachronism that the networks carry even a little bit of it, because it's not particularly interesting to most voters. Right. Most voters are not activists. They don't go to conventions. They don't go to rallies. They don't do any of this stuff. They tune in the last couple of months, and maybe not even with the convention, maybe after Labor Day. So I was surprised, actually, that it went as well as it did. And they've done a good job pacing. So it's maybe this is what they're going to do in the future. I don't know if they'll ever go back to a full four days in a week in-person convention with 15 minute set speeches. Maybe maybe we're getting a preview for what's to come.
Okay, Joe, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree that they've done a very good job with, you know, the virtual aspect of this. I was worried that you know, it wouldn't work at all, and I find myself watching and listening much more closely than I have been in the last couple of conventions, because it moves very quickly. It's very message rich. You know, you get a real sense of what the Democrats are running on. And, you know, one last thing, in addition to, I loved the roll call. It reminded you of what was great about America, and we haven't seen that a lot lately. But one thing on Biden, which is, I don't know that the public at large, the non-activists, know Joe Biden. The primaries were very strange. He lost the first couple. People talked about him as a loser. He won South Carolina, and COVID hit and took over the news cycle. So I think this is very valuable for him to have Jill Biden talk about his strengths, since, you know, so many others, John McCain talking about his relationship, Colin Powell, all of that. It's valuable and important for Biden.
No, I think that's an important point, because I think, you know, we think of him as a known quantity. I'm not sure that he is a known quantity. And is that, no, I'm repeating myself. I've said this on every single podcast, but I do think that his speech is going to be interesting and important later this week, because the Republicans have invested so much energy into portraying him as completely out of touch, out of it, that he's suffering from dementia. And I think he will benefit from this. Okay, so I did see one critique this morning that I thought was interesting, that you look at some of the figures who were trotted out last night, you know, people in their 70s and their 80s. It was kind of a nostalgia looking back. John Kerry, Bill Clinton, Chuck Hagel, Colin Powell, even John McCain. These are guys in their 70s and 80s. And AOC only gets about 90 seconds. So is there any reason for concern that the Democrats that this is, I don't know, it's skewing old, that it's a lot of nostalgia rather than tapping into a lot of that youthful energy that they would like to be pushing this year? Shirish.
I think that was a conscious decision. You know, I'm not privy to the inner workings of the convention planning, but it seems like the message that Joe Biden certainly has pushed is, I'm normal. I'm not Donald Trump. You're not going to have to check your phones every morning at 6:30 to see whether we're about to invade North Korea or whether we've, you know, invaded South Korea just for fun. You know, this is his entire campaign was, look, I'll make it so that you don't have to worry about what's going on in the White House anymore. You can ignore me. And it worked. You know, when the opponent is Donald Trump, you want a sense of normalcy. You want people who have been adult, rational leaders in the past. And what you don't want is people going up there and throwing a lot of bombs and saying stuff about Medicare for all, maybe, or, you know, some of the other things that the activists really want to hear, but is not necessarily helpful in this election cycle. You know, in a way, this election reminds me a lot of 2004 when, you know, Howard Dean was the heartthrob. And voters in Iowa, in the end, said, we want someone who's going to beat George W. Bush. And the person who's most likely to do that is John Kerry. Sorry, Howard. And that's how things shook out.
But John Kerry didn't win that election.
He didn't, but he came probably closer. Remember, it was Ohio. Had Ohio gone the other way, and it was pretty close there, he would have won. And I don't know that Howard Dean would have come anywhere near that.
So since we're on this issue of John Kerry, and I find myself using the phrase I'm not a fan of a lot lately. You know, I'm not a fan of John Kasich, but I thought he did pretty well. I thought that John Kerry's speech last night was short, but it was impactful. And I think I mentioned before we started, every single sentence seemed designed, you know, as a direct heat-seeking missile into Donald Trump's cranium, just pounding him and, you know, talking about, you know, the blooper reel, raising the issue of Russian interference, raising the issue again of the Russian bounties on the Afghans, of our troops in Afghanistan, by the way, which is a story that, where the hell is that story? But I also was really struck by his embrace of American exceptionalism and the way that Donald Trump has abandoned that. And that was one of those moments where I thought, you know, there's a lot of what he is saying that could have been spoken at a Republican convention a couple of cycles ago. Joe, I thought it was an impactful speech.
Yeah, I agree with that. I tweeted halfway through John Kerry bringing the heat. I was a little surprised that, you know, he was as strong as he was. I think last night was very purposeful. If you look at polls, the thing the public wants more than anything is to break the gridlock in Washington. They want bipartisanship. So that's why we saw a lot of older people last night, people who could vouch and validate the Joe Biden reaches across the aisle. John Kerry, I mean, I think Bill Clinton on the domestic policy framed the choice. John Kerry did something on foreign policy, which I think is pretty simple to sum up. He said, Donald Trump has embarrassed us in the world. Mm-hmm. He's undone decades of work that have kept Americans strong and kept America great. And now the world is laughing at us. I'm sure that got under the president's skin. Perhaps it went over his head. But it was a very, very important speech.
You know, and I think I mentioned this also as I was listening to that. I thought, boy, it almost sounds as if John Kerry was sitting down with the folks from the Lincoln Project, because some of those, I don't think that did go over his head. For Donald Trump, being laughed at is one of the great metrics in life. That's the one thing he hates the most. And so that was designed, it felt like, to go right at him, you know, that you haven't made America great. You haven't made America respected. You know, you have become a clown on the national stage. And I thought that was a very, very powerful target. Now, so we haven't seen Trump lashing back. He probably is waiting for Fox and Friends to broadcast an excerpt of it. Sharish, have you seen anything? Has he risen to the bait yet with John Kerry?
Not at Kerry. I mean, I saw a string of tweets last night, and I'll be honest, I only read like half of them because I was trying to get something else done. But, you know, he took offense at Michelle Obama's remarks the other day. He can't stop insulting AOC. Maybe he missed that speech. It wasn't very long, you know, and to the Zinger's point, I remember John Kerry was able to unload a few of those against George W. Bush. The thing was, his speech would be 45 minutes long, and he'd have maybe a minute and a half of zingers. Well, last night we excised the 43 and a half minutes, and there you go. So that's why it was probably, it seemed a lot more powerful, because we distilled it down to getting under Trump's skin and nothing else.
Okay, so one of the big stories yesterday, and I think this connects to a lot of what we're talking about, including the president's relationship to truth and some of the things that Joe was just mentioning. And we have to, I think, pause to put this into context. You had this Republican-run Senate Intelligence Committee report released. It's nearly 1,000 pages long, and it documents the extent of the Trump campaign's connection with Russia and all of the things they did and all of the sleaze of Paul Manafort and Roger Stone. Certainly, it suggests that the president lied to the special counsel here. There are these dazzling details, including how these Kremlin-directed operatives popped open champagne when Donald Trump won the presidency. There's this quote from the report. "We uncorked a tiny bottle of champagne, took one gulp each, and looked into each other's eyes. We uttered almost in unison, 'We made America great,' one operative at the St. Petersburg-based Internet Research Agency said in a message obtained by the Republican-led committee." Now, gentlemen, I don't think this is going to change anyone's mind, but historians are going to look back on this and go, damn, you know, this dropped in the middle of August of 2020, and it paints a devastating portrait of what this president did and blows up the whole narrative that this was merely a hoax. Your thoughts, Joe?
Yeah, I agree with you. And that little sigh reflects the fact that sometimes the media doesn't cover a story because they're bored with it. Mm-hmm. And that's tragic. We knew a lot of these things. Mueller had some of them. We didn't have them in such great detail. But this has the Republican stamp on it. I mean, Marco Rubio could have buried this report if he wanted to. Both the Republicans and the Democrats wanted this information out because it was important for the American public to see it. And we see in very great detail the Roger Stone episodes, the Paul Manafort giving the Russians targeting information. And the one thing that, I try to only explode my head from being mad once a day. In reading that report, what exploded my head yesterday is what a historically evil figure Bill Barr will be going forward. The whole idea of him taking the Mueller report and turning it on its head and creating that first impression that for a lot of Americans that Trump was exonerated has never left. And mm-hmm. I think he will pay no price right now, but historically he will go down as the worst attorney general in history.
Shirish?
Yeah, I've got to agree with that. I mean, he basically 100% lied about the essence of the Mueller report. And remember, some of us, not many, but some of us were saying this in real time as it was happening in October of 2016. I mean, the president got his very first intelligence briefing in August of 2016. Now, reporting later, learned that, yeah, that's when he was first told that the DC leaks, that the WikiLeaks material had been coming from Russia. So he knew in August that the Russians were stealing this stuff. In October, on the day of the Access Hollywood tape, that was the same day that DHS and ODNI put out that report saying, oh, by the way, this stuff is coming from Russia and WikiLeaks is its agent. So here we have to the public on the record that all this stuff that's being leaked day by day is a Russian operation. And what does Trump do starting on October 10th? Every single day at his rallies, he would praise WikiLeaks, saying they're great, doing a great public service, and isn't Hillary corrupt, and look, you can read for yourself, and on and on and on. And to his credit, I remember Marco Rubio during those weeks say, look, I'm not talking about WikiLeaks because I don't think that we ought to be using stuff from Russia. Someday the Democrats will be benefiting from this. They'll be going after us. And other countries shouldn't be involved in our campaigns. So, you know, we all knew this was happening right as it was happening. And it's amazing that years later, the president and his enablers are still getting away with saying, oh, no, it's a hoax. And this proves there was no collusion. No, it most certainly does not. It proves there was tons of collusion.
Okay, a couple of points that are really important here. Number one, Andrew Weissman, who was part of Mueller's team, was on Nicole Wallace's show yesterday, and she asked him, she said, did you learn anything? Is there anything new in this report. And I think the assumption was, of course, you guys knew all this stuff, right? And he said, no, there were some details that he was not aware of, which I think is very significant. No, number two, to your point, the thing about the Russia, you know, scandal has been that it was so in our face. It was playing out in real time. Every aspect of it, the obstruction of justice, it was being played out, you know, on Twitter, everything that was happening. I also have long thought that October 7th, 2016 was just a pivotal day in our politics. That, of course, was the day the Access Hollywood video was dropped. And, you know, this report really, I think, very graphically describes how Roger Stone gets on the phone, basically, and says, we have to drop the WikiLeaks stuff on Podesta right now. So sure enough, you have these massive, you know, controversy about that Access Hollywood video, followed almost immediately by this Russian leak that gave Donald Trump this talking point that you just talked about here. So this is one of the things about this, Joe, is that, and I don't know, I was trying to think who said this, you know, that there may be secrets, but there are no mysteries with Donald Trump. We know all of this. We have known it for years. Now, a huge portion of the electorate, you know, lives in an alternative reality bubble and may, you know, buy into a different narrative. But the reality is that, and again, historians are going to look back on this and go, you all knew all this stuff. Going into this election, this was all laid out on the public record, wasn't it? None of this is a surprise.
We didn't know all this in 2016. But in 2020, we do know all of this. But so much of Donald Trump has become normalized. This idea, I mean, the president of the United States going after people in very personal terms on Twitter, which is an official communication from the president of the United States. He has done so many things wrong that people now kind of shrug their shoulders. You say, well, he's corrupt. People say, well, we know he's corrupt. Well, he's a liar. Well, we know he's a liar. And for his base, there's just no turning them because he has done a couple of things that they want more than anything. So I think, you know, the point I'd make, and I think I alluded to before, I think this is on the media to pick this ball up and run with it. You know, very few people read the Mueller report, and that was 448 pages. Even fewer are going to read the 1,000 pages of the Senate Intel report. It's up to journalists and Democratic politicians. I don't want to put it all on the media to go out and articulate to the public that this happened. This is still happening. The president lied before what is a grand jury basically with the special counsel interview, and all of this stuff matters.
And where are the hearings? I mean, shouldn't there be hearings next week into this? This is something that people in Congress can do, right?
Well, I think the Democrats have concluded, and they're probably right that the public has made up their mind on that. And for those who are still going to vote for Donald Trump, they're okay with the fact that the Russians are helping them because he should be president and he should get help from any place else. Secondly, there are at this point at least equally pressing issues that for the Democrats they have to go after. The response to COVID-19, the blatant attempts to steal the election, you know, lately now using the United States Postal Service. It's just you got to pick your poison.
Yeah, no, I'm going to come back to that, and especially the Postal Service in just a moment. I'm going to read something to you guys, though. I went back last weekend and I was rereading Elizabeth Drew's Washington Journal, which is her real-time account of Watergate and Richard Nixon's fall. And at one point in 1974, this is what she wrote. This is 1974. She says, I wonder whether the enormity of his lying, Nixon's, has sunk in yet, whether we have or can come to terms with the thought that so much of what he said to us was just noise, words, and that we can no longer begin by accepting any of it as the truth. This is a total reversal of the way we were brought up to think about presidents, a departure from deeply ingrained habits. one's mind resists the thought that our president is a faithless man, capable of looking at us in utter sincerity from the other side of the television camera and telling us multiple explicit, barefaced lies. And when I read that, I thought that really felt like something from a different era, a more naive age, because back in 1974, you could actually be shocked by a president lying. But, you know, as you pointed out, Sharish, you know, it's not shocking anymore. It's become a way of life. It's like our background noise, right? I mean, you know, the last 4 years, it's just been pounded into us. And to Joe's point, we do get numb. We do get bored with this, don't we?
Yeah, I you know, I had this vague memory of looking at some polling data from 1974 as I was doing a couple of pieces back during impeachment. And I seem to remember that Nixon's approval rating was down into like the low 30s or high 20s even.
Yes.
Which basically was, I don't care what Richard Nixon did, I'm with him no matter what. That was his ceiling. That was his, you know, they're Republicans, they're going to support him. They didn't care. But the difference was that the United States Republican senators said, you know, we're not going to go along with this. And it's in our long-term interest for us not to support you here. And we're going to vote to remove you when it gets to us. And that's what made him quit. So the difference is, number one, I guess we did not have a Democratic Senate. I believe in 1974. No. And number two, other than Mitt Romney, I don't know any other person who said, you know, this far and no more. And this is on McConnell. McConnell could have gotten rid of Trump back in January. And imagine how, just on a side note, just imagine how a President Mike Pence would have dealt with this pandemic compared to Donald Trump. So, you know, decisions have consequences. And this is, you know, we talk about Bill Barr's legacy. I think this is going to be one of Mitch McConnell's bigger legacies than his judges, that he did this.
You know, you guys probably remember this in real time. One of the great mysteries, I'm sorry to spend some time on Watergate. One of the great mysteries of Watergate is why Richard Nixon didn't destroy those tapes. Because you can imagine Trump and Bill Barr sitting around going, well, there's tapes of all of this. And what are the chances that they wouldn't have just said, burn them? Throw them away. We're never going to turn them over. It's kind of amazing when you realize that Richard Nixon not only kept, but he actually turned them over when the courts told him to turn them over. You know, again, that seems like a different world, doesn't it, Joe?
It does. You know, one of the things that is different is the courts moved with great speed and purpose in the Nixon case because they saw this as an issue that threatened our democracy and threatened the executive branch and the presidency. I think the Trump team has figured out that the courts don't move with that urgency any longer. And they realized that there was really no one to push back against them. They stiffed Congress and they have stiffed the courts, and this will not be resolved until after the election. None of these issues will be resolved until after the elections. And you know, I'm certain that Richard Nixon would have loved to have strung this out for the rest of his term and not have to resign. It boggles the mind, you know, why it takes a judge 3 months to schedule a hearing on something that impacts all Americans.
So, Joe, you said something. You dropped something that I was going to follow up on before about the Senate report being released right now at this moment, and that Marco Rubio could have buried it. So the Republicans did not have to release this report. Why did they then?
Well, I think that Marco Rubio and the Republicans knew if they didn't release the report, Mark Warner would. And they're... Sometimes hiding something in plain sight is better than hiding something in a obscure place. For Mark Warner to get up and say, they won't release this, but I'm going to tell you, you know, in a digestible way what it says, I think is likely politically more dangerous. And I think they just assumed, they took a bet, and I think they're right, that the country's tired of this. The media's tired of this. It's like, who cares that Russia helped Trump get elected? And that's the sad part about this, because that is Marco Rubio's bet.
Sharish, why do you think they released it?
Well, I agree with Joe. I think that this has been going on for 3 years. They've got so many documents and so much there that has been ready for release that Mark Warner would have just jumped up and down and pitched a fit and held news conference. And people might have even leaked it. You know, who knows? And that would have been devastating if it came out that this stuff in this detail after being leaked basically proved that not only did Trump do this, that the Republicans in the Senate were basically trying to cover it up for him, which would have been way worse than just, as Joe said, just putting it out there and putting it aside. One other small bit, though, Marco Rubio still has presidential aspirations, all right? And I've been thinking about this. I mean, I covered him when he was a freshman lawmaker in the Florida House. I think he understands that if Trump were to lose this fall, that's not so bad for people who, like him, who might want to run in 2024, who are not and never going to be anything like Donald Trump. And a useful thing for those sorts of people would be to get this cleansing over with now, rather than having to try to, you know.
I think you guys are probably right. I guess I was nursing the naive thought that one of the reasons they decided to release it was because they were concerned about ongoing Russian interference in the election, and they wanted to sort of, you know, throw out a brushback pitch because they knew that if they didn't do something about this, that the administration or the law enforcement would not take an aggressive enough approach to that. But that does feel naive. Okay, so
Charlie, yes. I wish you could see the incredulous look on my face right now. 52 Republican senators voted to acquit a president without calling a single witness when it was clear that he had broken the law and was not fit to be president. There's just in the Republican caucus in the Senate, it is the reflection of Mitch McConnell, and it's all about power. It's all about keeping power. And, you know, they don't want, I mean, Mitch McConnell had a chance in 2016 to go out and throw a brushback pitch when the Gang of Eight was briefed about Russian interference, and Mitch McConnell said no. So there's no surprise here.
So let's talk about the post office. Yesterday, under tremendous pressure, Trump's postmaster general appeared to back off somewhat, said he's going to suspend any further changes to the postal service between now and the election. Some Democrats are saying that's not enough because he needs to undo the changes he's already made. So, Joe, you've mentioned this a couple of times. This has been the dominant story over the last couple of days. Does this go away?
No, it doesn't, because I think it's part of a broader pattern. I think Donald Trump and his team is, you know, he's got some smart people on his team. They know that if everyone goes out and votes, they're going to lose, and they're going to lose badly. So what they feel they must do is suppress the vote. And they have a number of tools in their toolbox. One is voting laws in states. They've, I think, put aside $20 to $30 million, and they have 1,000 lawyers to try to tie up secretaries of state to make it harder for people to vote. This is another one. They want people to believe that it is not legitimate. And, you know, why bother to vote if the whole thing's a fraud or if it's rigged? And the third, this is not a tool, this is the most dangerous part of it, is he's undermining the legitimacy of the election. You know, it is, we've never had a moment in American history where it was, that anyone would take seriously if I jumped up and down and said, I don't think Donald Trump's going to leave the Oval Office if he loses. That's not impossible right now.
Sharish, what happens now with the Postal Service?
I think the Democrats keep pounding on this because it is happening right now. It is designed to suppress the Democratic vote. Obviously, I mean, in fact, the president even said so. People are accusing the Democrats of the conspiracy theory. Well, it's not as much of a conspiracy theory when Trump basically admits to it. So that he made it a little bit easier for Pelosi and for Schumer to continue pounding on this. And on the point of he might not leave the White House, and that's, I mean, yeah, of course, I cannot predict Donald Trump. I've given up trying. However, I was impressed and relieved the day that I think Esper and I think Milley both apologized for taking part in the clearing of Lafayette Square and the tear gassing and beating of people so that Trump could go hold a Bible upside down from the church that he's never been to. So that was a, I thought, a good day for democracy, because that was a brushback pitch right there. That was telling the president that, no, we're not going along with your fascist stuff, because that honestly what that was. And that was a good day for America, I thought. And I think that lesson probably has stuck, that he cannot count on his being commander in chief in order to play games with the election and its aftermath. So at least that's something. You know, I mean, he'll continue messing with the post office for a while, I think, in other ways maybe. But
well, it is extraordinary, just stopping for a moment, that the president of the United States would be casting question on the legitimacy of the democratic process, because, you know, that there's going to be long-term damage, whatever the outcome is. And, you know, unlike other candidates, you know, the Bob Doles, the Al Gores of the world, the Richard Nixons of the world back in 1960, who were prepared to lose, it's not clear that he is prepared to acknowledge that. I think he's going to leave. I think he'll create a grievance movement. But he's willing to do all of this damage. You know, so for example, you know, I'm seeing the president here in Wisconsin who's joking about, well, he should get a third term because of the Russia stuff and everything. And of course, his defenders say, oh, he's just trolling you. This is his humor. He's just trying to own the libs. Here's the president of the United States using the biggest platform in the world to stoke this kind of anxiety. And is it the irresponsibility of that is really extraordinary. But going back to the mail thing, there have been reports that I think have been somewhat overblown about the mailboxes that were being removed, some of the sorting places that were being shut down. Some of that, I think, in retrospect, appears to have been normal maintenance, normal organization. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a problem. And as you point out, Shirish, the president admits it out loud. And that's the thing about this president, that, you know, there can be no conspiracy because he's going to announce it. I also think that this is one of the stupidest things I've ever seen. Yes, I agree that suppressing the vote has now become central to their strategy, but isn't part of that strategy, shouldn't it be to not let people know that's your strategy? I mean, normally, if you're going to suppress the vote, do you like it, make it clear and signal 3 months in advance, by the way, we're going to be suppressing votes? I mean, that seems profoundly stupid.
I've often thought about what would have happened if Donald Trump had been Richard Nixon, right, after the Watergate stuff was coming. He would have gone out there, yeah, well, we got there and there was really nothing good to steal. So I don't even know what the point of that break-in was. So we moved on.
Yeah. He's got a pattern of, I didn't do it. I might have done it. If I did do it, there was nothing wrong with it. And we would have seen that if he was Richard Nixon. Let me give you one further level of stupid with voter suppression, only on the post office. Vote by mail has traditionally been better for Republicans than it has been for Democrats. And what's happened is, if you look at the polls, you now have something like 70 to 80% of Democrats saying they're going to vote by mail, and something like 20% of Republicans saying they're going to vote by mail. That has to scare them, because, you know, we will likely have some problems with the post office, but it is a lot more predictable and dependable to get someone's vote when they have 30 days to drop something in the mailbox than it is for them to get on a line someday and go in and vote. So in addition to it being, you know, in the category of dirty tricks, I think it's kind of stupid.
Yeah. I remember down in Florida, I mean, I covered Jeb Bush when he was governor. Jeb Bush had been Miami GOP chairman, you know, in the early 1990s. And when he kind of took control of the party in 94, it became the mission to make early voting, in other words, absentee voting at the time. That was how they were going to bank all their votes before Election Day. And that's how they really started upping their game compared to the Democrats. And now those folks are beside themselves that Trump is denigrating this. So
that is exactly the same story in Wisconsin. And it was Reince Priebus when he became the chairman here. And one of the reasons why Republicans were successful in Wisconsin in flipping the state from red to from blue to red is because they emphasize those early voting, the mail-in vote. Okay, so in the time that we have left, this is Kamala Harris's big night tonight. Give me your take on what she does and does not do for the ticket. Your reaction to her selection, Joe Lockhart.
I think she reinforces the two most important constituencies for Democrats, blacks as a whole, black women in particular, and women in the country, particularly suburban women. I think she gives people reason to get out and take the step to vote in a way that other VPs have not done for Democrats, you know, in the last three or four cycles.
Yeah, Sharish. I totally agree. Back when he pretty much locked up the nomination and the speculation of who the VP would be, and he'd already said it was going to be a woman, I didn't understand what all the hand wringing and the speculation was about. It was going to be Kamala Harris. I mean, she obviously with the vice president's age, you have to be able to say that, yeah, this person tomorrow could be president. Well, she was vetted during the campaign. No one found out just really bad stuff about her, so that's safe. She's a black woman, which is a huge constituency. I thought everything else was just kind of maybe doing due diligence, but in the end, I assumed it was going to be Senator Harris, and sure enough, I mean, I think she's a good choice, a safe choice, and a very smart choice.
And Bates, the Republicans, and Donald Trump proved that he could not resist taking that bait and revealing sort of his worst instincts. Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 100, gentlemen, how concerned are you about Joe Biden's, shall we say, stamina, mental, cognitive stamina between now and November? This is going to be a big issue. It's going to be front and center over the next 48 hours. So just give me some sense. How do you state this? So 1 to 100, like 100, you're really worried about it. 1, hey, no big deal at all. So, Sharish.
I don't know, maybe 10 or 15.
Oh, really? You're not worried?
Not that worried. I mean, he went through this long-ass primary process. You know, I remember walking into an event that he had in New Hampshire on the assumption that he was not going to go anywhere, and this might be the last time I ever see Joe Biden on the stump. And he was fine. He was totally fine. And okay. I just moved on. And by the way, he's running against a guy who's proud of being able to say, you know, person, woman, man, camera, TV. So let's not forget that.
He should start his acceptance speech by saying that. So, Joe, how one being you're not worried at all, 100 being, oh my God, it's going to be white knuckle between now and November.
Yeah, I'd say maybe 5. I'm not worried at all, and for two reasons. One is this is going to be a different campaign than we've ever seen before. COVID is not going away, so I don't think you're going to see the sort of 5 stops a day rallies where even someone who is 25. I mean, I've done 5 presidential campaigns. I traveled full time for Walter Mondale. I was exhausted at the end of every day. I couldn't make sense of even where I was. Secondly, Joe Biden's a very competitive guy. He does not like to lose. And he has got, you know, that old phrase, the fire in the belly. He's got that. And to the extent that things get better and they're out on a traditional trail, he's got what he needs to perform well and to do it over a long time. And let's not forget that one of the most important part about important features of this campaign is how short it is.
Yes,
it is going to be a 60-day sprint, and 30 days into that sprint, somewhere like a half of the voters will have voted.
Joe, this is why, Joe, you're not just another pretty face. Because I think that one of the key elements is this coronavirus campaign. The fact that it isn't going to be, you know, the marathon sprint running, the exhausting, pressing the flesh, you know, constant, unscripted events. In that sense, Joe Biden has really, this has been is a great gift for him. And it deprives Donald Trump of something that he really loves. He doesn't get to have the rallies, but Joe Biden doesn't need to go through run this gauntlet of all of this. Also, I think it's baked into the cake. Yes, he's going to make gaffes. Yes, he's going to say things. Yes, he's going to lose this string of thought. But number one, he's running against Donald Trump. Number two, I think people look at Joe Biden and goes, he's old Joe Biden. And yeah, he might not be 100%, but it's benign. I'm willing to accept that. He's the, you know, we're okay with him because he is a good guy. And as a result, I just don't think, I'm trying to think of the worst case scenario of, you know, some sort of a bad meltdown, some bad moment in the debate or something. I just don't think that's going to be decisive, but we will see. And gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me, Shirish Date and Joe Lockhart, for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast and being so generous with your time.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Our special convention coverage continues. I'm Charlie Sykes. There are 76 days to go until the election.